you have to really have a lot of faith in what you're doing and really believe in what you're doing sometimes, because you will hear all kinds of nonsense.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Lady Hubbard, author of The Last Suspicious Holdout, a linked short story collection that began as an exploration of the 20-year period preceding President Obama's historic election in 2008.
I was suspicious of my own cynicism. My mom was so happy, you know, and you'd see all these, everything has changed. And I didn't really feel that. And so I wanted to talk about my own grief and my own sort of inability to not be incredibly suspicious of what does this actually mean in terms of where this country is heading and what's actually going on.
Letting her inner angst fuel her creativity, Lady's novels and stories are a reflection of the feelings she's trying to work out for herself. She explains how the need for community led her to want to write professionally. Plus, why she decided to get an MFA after already earning a PhD and having children. And the gift she gave Toni Morrison that was really a gift to herself. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. First question, when did you know that you were a writer?
Oh, wow. Well, I think I always knew I liked to write from a very early age. It was just very important to me. I think it took me a lot longer to think of myself as becoming someone that aspired to become a professional writer. So it was very personal, do you know?
Yeah, I think you're the first person to like distinguish between like personal writing and professional writing. So what was the tipping point for you to say, okay, I want to do this professionally?
Realizing that I literally did not have time to write as much because I had three kids and I had a job. And I was like, wow, like you actually spend a lot of your time writing, do you know? And it was getting squeezed out increasingly. And so it felt like if this is something that is so important to me and I want to keep doing it, I need to try to find a way that I can think of it as potentially a job. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I have two kids of my own. So, but yeah. I wonder if you had been able, I don't know, in some miraculous way to find a balance to continue to write personally and do all the things that you were doing with work and home, do you think you would have ever ventured into trying to write professionally had you been able to fulfill that for yourself as you had been doing before?
Yeah, that's interesting too, because honestly, other things were going on in my life. I'm in New Orleans and I actually moved here right before Katrina. And I think that actually had a huge effect on me in terms of feeling that it was important to sort of assert not just my voice, but for people to assert their voices. That's really when I started sort of submitting things to be published. And so it was like both of those things. I think I was getting more into doing that as a habit because it really made me think about the value of my voice and other people's voices and wanting to communicate. Do you know what I mean?
Makes perfect sense.
Does it make I don't know if these are like vague answers.
No, it makes sense of like being in a community that then is devastated by disaster. It becomes important to tell stories.
Yes.
And
yes,
being a part of that community and adopting it as your own, your voice then becomes a part of one of those that needs to be heard and tell your story. So that does make sense to me.
Yeah. So, yeah, it really made me think about issues like that, I think, in a different way. And like, why didn't I try to share myself and sort of the value of that was really reinforced It seems kind of indirect, but for me, it felt very direct at the time. Like, I'm going to put my voice out there too. I think it's important. That was already something that had started. And I think that when I had my third child, I was like, oh, wow, you're not going to have time, like literally to just be like, this is something I do whenever I have a moment to spare. Do you know what I mean? Because I was working, I had two kids already. And I think that it just, I realized that people might have told me that, like, you're not going to have time to do things the way you've been doing them, or to keep doing them the way you've been doing them. Yeah.
Yes. The levels of crazy I have just with my two children and then writing a novel shortly after my daughter was born.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand that very well. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, so two things. What were you doing professionally before you decided to pursue writing as a career? Mm-hmm. And what did your pursuit of writing as a career look like?
So while all this was happening, the reason I moved to New Orleans, I was teaching in the Africana Studies department or program at Tulane University. That's why I moved here. And then I was also teaching in the theater and dance department here. So yeah, totally, totally different thing. So it really did feel like just the way my life had worked out or was working out, that writing fiction was something I did like on the side, because it was just a very different, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's what I was doing.
So having done all of that initially, mm-hmm. and then deciding that you were going to start submitting and putting your voice out there, and you already having a PhD, did you go back to school for writing, or did you
I did. Ooh. I went, yeah, I don't know. Maybe in part it was to make it real definite. I applied for an MFA in creative writing when I was pregnant.
Third son. So you are as crazy as I am. It's fine.
Yeah. No, and I think a lot of people thought I was crazy too, because I was like, no, I'm quitting my job, and I'm going up there with two kids and a 4-month-old baby, and I'm going to write a novel.
I love it so much. Oh,
it's funny in retrospect. Yeah.
Yes.
It was terrifying at the time. And I think a lot of people did think I was a little, something was not, maybe it was hormones or something. Like, what is she doing? But I'm so grateful that I trusted myself enough to do that. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. And so is that when you started working on your debut novel?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And did
The Talented Ripkins, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then were you working on the stories in The Last Suspicious Holdout at the same time? Because I've had people say, you do stories and a novel in the program, and then it depends on what comes out first.
Right. Well, no, the first chapter of The Talented Ripkins is an adaptation of a short story that I had published a couple years prior. And I really wanted to write more about the characters. So I went there very specifically focused on writing that. But I have been working on the stories that wound up in the collection for a long time. Yeah, but they were very separate gestures. Getting the MFA was really about trying to carve out the space and time to write that first novel.
Okay, so this goes to a question that you answered when we were at the Louisiana Book Festival, but I'm going to ask you again. How do you know when a story wants to be more than just a short story, but has the capacity to be a novel?
Yeah, I don't see. That's probably an intuitive thing, too. I just really love the character. There was Johnny Ripkins, and I think it's in part because that was very inspired by my grandfather, that character and the relationship. Because the book is about a relationship between a man in his 70s and his niece. And that relationship was very personal to me. And so when I wrote the story, I just really wanted to stay with the characters longer. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like I needed to say more. But it's interesting because sometimes I have written stories as well, and they just are not working. And I'll try everything, and then I'll eventually realize you're not giving them enough space to breathe. And this wants to be a much larger piece. And that it's actually me that's not a, like, maybe I don't want to commit the time that it's asking me to commit. Do you know what I'm saying? So sometimes it takes me a while to figure those things out. But I think I really, in terms of expanding that novel, I just really wanted to stay with those characters for a while.
I think I just lost my question. I don't know. So then in working on being very intent on, you know, going through the MFA program to stay with those characters, what did your publishing journey look like?
Well, that was another thing about going and getting an MFA. I'm really glad I did that. The circumstances were a bit, they were a lot. So it was a huge leap of faith. And honestly, for me, it was just, I'm really grateful for that. So that's how I met the woman that became my agent, was through like contacts that you get at MFAs and just opportunities to put your work in front of people. So I actually, she read a very, very rough draft and must have just seen something in it, because I was actually really surprised, because I think I was still like, you know, when you, you're like, okay, this is an opportunity, so I'm going to pretend I'm more ready than I actually am. So that's how it felt. And I was like, oh, like, because I, you know, I didn't feel like I even had like enough of a draft to show anyone, but I was kind of, I had sort of presented myself as if I did. So she read a very, very rough draft and she must have seen something with it. And it took a while after that to sort of, she worked with me on trying to refine it and stuff like that. And with that book, I know it felt like I got a lot of responses from publishers. There were, seemed to be, what was coming back to me was a lot of concern with how you would market that particular story, which kind of seems strange. This was 5 years ago. That's not that long ago. But at the time, it's just like, this is such a, I mean, I think the idea of a novel that's focused on a road trip between, you know, a 7-year-old African-American man who's caregiver to a 12-year-old girl, do you know, and there's other stuff going on. There's other reasons why, because they all have talents, right? Mm-hmm. So there's sort of that element of it too. But I got a lot of the comments were saying that they didn't have any idea how you would market a book like that. Does that make sense? Or
it makes sense, but it's the answer from publishing that frustrates me the most. Yeah. Because, mm-hmm. Okay, it's something that you've never seen. That should be, you know, that should be something I would think that as a publisher, that would be something exciting to try to figure out how to market and bring it to people. Because if you continue to publish the same types of stories, then you just keep having the same types of stories.
Right.
And there is no nuance and there is no difference. And I heard from a publishing professional that like one of the houses, the name is Random House, because that's how they publish. It's at that's random.
Funny. That's like, funny. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So that kind of answer really frustrates me a lot. Again, aside. So then how did you overcome that kind of feedback?
I don't know. It's funny because people are saying, oh, you need to have your own voice. But then I often felt like, you know, my own voice was unique, but it didn't fit. So I think that was not such a daunting refrain for me. So you just kept trying. And eventually it was published by Melville House, which is an independent publisher. And that was really great. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird. I mean, you really have to really have a lot of faith in what you're doing and really believe in what you're doing sometimes, because you will hear all kinds of nonsense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So then 3 kids, several advanced degrees and rejection. How did you get yourself to keep going through all of that when I'm sure everyone around you was like, what are you doing?
Well, no, I mean, I think at that point, because it was all very internal and I had reasons for doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like there are reasons why I am writing and trying to publish my work and trying to communicate with other people. So for me, it was very, it had just become a very personal part of my, I guess, identity, you know? So there was no not trying at that point.
You know what I mean? Yeah, you're all in.
Yeah.
So then did you find the process more easier to navigate once you did the second novel, The Rib King, and then now your short story collection, The Last Suspicious Holdout?
Yes, definitely. And I'm really grateful. And that was one of the things that was really gratifying about publishing the first novel was it did not seem to confuse a lot of people. You know what I mean? Like, it did not seem, people weren't like, what is this? And people seemed to understand what I was trying to do with that book. So, and that was extremely meaningful to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. When I saw the Toni Morrison blurb, I was like, ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Famous.
Yeah. Well, see, I met her when I was in college.
Okay.
So she was my thesis advisor in college. And that's another thing, too. I'm very grateful that I finally got it together and finished a novel in time to, like, present it to her. Do you know what I mean? Because it did take me a while to actually do that. And I'm very grateful that I was able to have the chance to show her my first book, at least. Yeah.
That's so beautiful. That makes the blurb even more, I'm sure, even more meaningful.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about these stories. When did you start writing them? And then when did you know that you had a collection?
The first story in the collection is actually the first full-length story I ever published. And the whole time I was writing the stories that are in it, I knew that they were all part of something larger. So they all, I had a whole series of stories, and they each had a specific date that was like from, you know, I mean, it's not the distant past, but it's the past. Because I actually started writing it maybe a couple years after Obama's election. And I was suspicious of my own cynicism. My mom was so happy, you know, and you'd see all these, this is everything has changed. And I didn't really feel that, you know? And so I think I wanted to talk about my own grief and my own sort of inability to not be incredibly suspicious of what does this actually mean in terms of where this country is heading and what's actually going on. And so I had this idea that I wanted to write about the 20 years that had preceded his election.
So the whole time
I was writing them, I wanted to write about the 20 years prior. So, and it took a really long time, obviously, to finish them. So, yeah, I always tell people I'm glad that worked out because, you know what I mean? Because it was like, what are you doing?
No, I get it. And so the collection is 92 to 2007, but there's a whole set of stories of those other years that are not here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because that was the thing, too. When I actually had to put it together, and my editor helped me with this, too. When I had to put it together, it just didn't, it's the internal rhythm of it, thinking of it as like a one whole piece. And that they're all, the stories are all really different, which is part of why it took so long. Like, they're all have very different structures. And then thinking about sort of the rhythm of the whole collection, it was just too much. Do you know what I mean? So I had to like cut out some years. So,
okay.
Yeah. Some things got moved around a little bit. So
I do remember my question from earlier when you were talking about writing stories, and there are stories that don't work, and it made my heart stop for a bit because I wanted to know, when the story is not working, do you just throw it away and like scrap it?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I feel so much better.
Oh yeah. No, I don't. I mean, some people might, but sometimes it takes me a really long time to figure out what's going on. And I have things that are, I have had, I don't know what it is. It'll just be like a little piece of something. And I know, and I, for some reason, it means something to me, but it'll take me like a very long time to figure out what it actually is. You know, so I keep things, and I at this point realize that I have I do that. So I don't throw things out, because it's very true that sometimes I have to put something aside for like a year, and then I'll go back. I'm like, oh, now this makes sense to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't throw things that mean something to me, even if I don't know what it is. I will hold on to until I figure it out. And a lot of times, again, I realize it has to do with finding the rhythm of a particular piece. Like, where is this going? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how does this feel? What is the actual shape of what this wants to be? Do you know what I mean? So it's more fully expressed. And that sometimes I have to put things aside because I can't see them. And then I'll look at them again and I can see them differently.
Okay.
And also too, sometimes I will write things and now be like, oh, this is, do you know? And it's really just because I'm in a bad mood. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're looking at your work and you can't really see it because of the mood you're in at that moment. And then I'll look at it again. I'll remember, oh, you thought this was terrible. And I'll read it. I'm like, oh, that's actually very interesting what you did there. Do you know? So I think I'm a little wary because I know I have a tendency to do that as well. Do you know?
Yeah.
So that's sort of how I defend against that, I think.
Yeah. I've been writing like, this is all trash, but I'm going to keep going because I got to figure out where it's going. But everything is trash. Throw the whole manuscript away.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't. See, I couldn't do that.
I didn't do that. Yeah. But I had to go back and be like, okay, there are good things here, but yeah, not in its current form.
Right.
And then go back to what you said, to shaping and making it be what it needed to be and what it wanted to be.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's do the reading. And I know I asked you to read Flip Lady, but I think my favorite story is The Night Nurses. So
Yeah.
Black and published family, it's time for the reading. The Last Suspicious Holdout is a linked collection of 13 stories anchored by the grief of what is lost when Black people lose community. The relationships between children and their parents, husbands, wives, and mistresses, brothers, and an assortment of familial and friendly connections address what it means to forge family from the wreckage of what racism and the war on drugs has left behind. Here's Lady.
Okay, so this is The Night Nurses. This is 2004 in the collection. All right, Night Nurses. It's all better now, and I know I am fortunate. But of course, they wouldn't just let us leave. Instead, they made us sit there in a dank little hospital room with hideous green walls and fluorescent lights hovering beneath the low ceiling like depression, until the doctor came in to do his rounds sometime around 11. I've been up since 5 when those 3 awful night nurses came to check my daughter's vitals and then berated me for giving her apple juice. "Don't you realize this is a laxative?" one of them said, a lumpy middle-aged white woman with a mole sprouting hair hanging off her left cheek. I was so exhausted by then, it was an effort just to keep my eyes open. I sat there, struggling to focus, while she shook the empty bottle in my face. "I thought I was supposed to be pushing fluids," I said, "and she wouldn't drink the Pedialyte." "Just get her cleaned up so we can change these bed linens," the second nurse said. A pale, prune-faced woman with hair standing on top of her head in stiff gray loops, as if she'd removed her curlers before leaving for work and then forgot to comb it out. Next to her was a third, a girl in her 20s with a greasy blonde ponytail pulled back from her acne-scarred face. She didn't say anything, just stood there with her arms folded in front of her chest and gave my daughter a pitying look. I staggered to my feet, grabbed the baby wipes, and stumbled to Mahalia's bedside. All 3 of the night nurses stood behind me and waited as I cleaned off her butt and legs. It was humiliating. I mean, I knew I'd made a mistake. I'd given her apple juice, but was it really that bad? Didn't they realize I'd been up all night? What right did they have to judge me? my mind reeled back to just a few hours before, when I'd stumbled through those emergency room doors with Mahalia in my arms, her breathing just a hoarse moan whispered in my ear. "Help me," I'd cried. Those same three nurses rushed into the lobby, squinted at my daughter, and promised everything would be okay. "Let's get her inside," the one with the mole said. They led us down a hall and into the examination room. But when I tried to lower Mahalia onto the table, she let out a tremendous wail as if terrified I was going to leave her there. "Oh, no, baby, we just want to look," the second nurse said. But Mahalia kept her body braced against mine, rigid with fear of the unknown. "It's not so bad if she's still making tears," the one with the ponytail confided. She backed away from us, nodding and smiling, all three of them talking in loud, animated voices that blended in and out with my daughter's screams. Then someone remembered the Barney video. They all started talking about the Barney video, and I turned around and saw the prune-faced woman wheel an ancient VCR into the room on a cart. The cabinet above the sink was opened, and one of them found a video with a familiar face of a purple dinosaur on the box. "See? It's okay." Mahalia looked at the TV screen. After a while, the pressure of her grip slackened, and I leaned forward and eased her onto the table. The night nurses lifted her shirt and took turns placing their hands on her stomach. One of them wheeled in the IV cart. Another one said, "Keep her still." A third reached for my daughter's hand and fingered the skin along her forearm. I put my arms around Mahalia's shoulders and held her to my chest while she twisted her head back and forth in a nervous smear of mucus and tears that seeped through the front of my shirt. I held my breath and said nothing. But I saw the way their fingers shook when they stuck Mahalia with that long needle, not once but three times before they found a good vein, a difficulty they swore was common with a child suffering from dehydration. I put my trust in these women and felt nothing but relief when they put Mahalia on that IV drip and wheeled her into the recovery room. Now I was not so sure.
So I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about your suspicions after Obama was elected in 2008 and how those suspicions turned out to be true in retrospect. We won't dwell.
I was going to say it's interesting to have finally finished it like last year. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like to have been working on that while he was president and stuff like that, and just sort of look at where the country has gone since then. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, but like just in putting those suspicions to work in this very specific time period prior to his election that I guess was really fraught with different types of tensions. I think one theme is always, you know, the drug crisis and crack epidemic in communities. Right. Why was it some of those eras in that specific period that made you want to do this collection of linked stories that included those themes?
Because I think I was really interested in the idea. I'm not saying everybody believed it because I know people are smarter than that. But that was often put forward that America was post-racial. Mm-hmm. And sort of the Obama election represented the culmination of sort of the, you know, all these problems have been solved, you know. And so I think part of why that period, or if you mentioned like the war on drugs, I think there was a lot of obfuscation. So instead of saying, you know, specifically or directly targeting Black people, you would have all these policies and things, and somehow the people that were affected the most were still the same group of people, but you're using different language. You're not using like racially specific terms. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But they're like, now they're like super predators and thugs, right? And welfare queens, and no one's saying Black people, but they are, do you know?
The dog whistles.
Yes. And crack baby too is so sick. It's like some of these things, they're not that long ago, but the idea of sort of turning a generation of babies into some sort of monstrous specter. Do you know, they're coming and they're all, you know, they're babies, but they're ruined for life, you know? And a lot of it was very cruel. And I think I was really interested in sort of the effects of the obfuscation in terms of what was going on. And there was all this, the way in which language was the meaning of words were felt like they were being sort of hollowed out. Also, it bothered me because I saw a lot of people talking about race as a basis of solidarity among people. So it was almost like if the idea of race is a construct and, you know, all these other things, how are you supposed to respond to racism if race isn't real, right? Mm. And you just fought like all these battles to sort of talk about how, you know, it's just this oppressive concept and stuff like that. So, and then I think the way in which class differences within the Black community were represented, because they are real, right? There are class issues and colorism and all kinds of stuff that needs to be dealt with. But it was almost as if in the media, they were like two separate worlds that didn't really have anything to do with each other. Mm-hmm. So you'd have all these images of really successful Black people, right? Or there's always a one Black best friend who's just kind of there in the movies, but he's fully assimilated and he fits. But he's totally divorced from the rest of sort of like a Black community or Black majority, mm-hmm. right? And instead, you're getting all of these really ugly negative signifiers. It's like there's one good one. There's always one good one. And the fact that there's one good one means that it's not all Black people that are like that, right? And I was just thinking about what that does to people's minds and also in terms of as a limit on sort of the ability to come together and work together, because it was often presented in the media as if people existed in two totally different worlds. So,
That's a lot.
I'm sorry. I was like,
it's okay. I got it.
It's not everything that I think, but that's like part of it. Do you know? I think that's part of why I was interested in the way race was represented during that period and how hard it made to sort of honestly express yourself or to express legitimate grievances, legitimate and potent responses that other people would hear and understand to what was going on. Do you know?
Yes. Yeah, so like with you saying all of that, it makes me think that, okay, I can see how the cynicism started, because if Obama is presented as the one good one and it's post-racial, and you think about that entire generation before or those years before that was demonized because of these different crises and epidemics and calling them crack babies and super predators and all of that, but that came out of the intentional destruction of the Black Power movement and the Black Panther Party specifically, which was supposed to be, before Obama, the one good ones, but for the Black community.
Right. No. Right. And at a certain point, it becomes illegible to people, right? Yes. I think that's a huge thing as well in terms of the discrediting of the Black Power movement and stuff like that. And sort of decomplicating it, making it seem not nearly as complex as it actually was, because that's very true. The amount of trauma that people went through at that time.
But in talking about the trauma that people went through at that time, I think about how much of that trauma did they suffer or did they inflict in a means of survival, specifically in that first story, Flip Lady. When I got to the end, my jaw dropped. I was like, no! So in writing these stories, it almost seems as if you're peeling back that layer of the what and looking at the why and the how of it. Mm. And I don't know if, was that intentional on your part to like, to try to get to those deeper issues that are beyond the surface of race and labels and name calling to like, you know, what's the emotion behind it or what's the reason and the why?
Yes. Because, and that's interesting too. I think in general, I'm more interested in how people of color, broadly speaking, interact with each other and sort of how racism and external forces affect how they interact with each other. and emotionally. And it is when you evoke all of the assassinations and just, again, trauma that that period of history that preceded when I'm writing about represented. For me, the a thing that connects all of the stories in that collection is grief and how the difficulty. A lot of the characters for me they don't have an outlet to express grief. And so they're trying to carry on despite it. They're hurting each other because of it. And that's part of what I was talking about in terms of the hollowing out of language. Because some of them, I think, and it's not a deficit on their part, because it's a deficit I myself have sometimes felt. It's just the difficulty of articulating what you feel needs to be articulated, given the vocabulary we have. Or what you're told is understandable. So, like, for example, a lot of the issues in terms of obviously the police and violence against Black people, those are not new issues. The people have been saying that for a very long time and no one has been listening. It's like it didn't make sense. And then there's like this moment in American history where, now this makes sense to me. I can actually engage you as opposed to thinking you're paranoid or you have your own issues and it's not true, it's not real. So that kind of stuff is part of what I was talking about too, because it makes it difficult to feel like you can communicate a very real experience and actually be heard and understood and responded to. And so I think that's like for me writing it, that was a big part of what the book was about.
So I feel like your writing process and the way that you come to story is very cerebral. And
I don't know.
Talking to you, it seems that way. So then, like, is there something that you want people to take from the work as a whole that you're doing?
I think it's cerebral in the sense that some things will bother me or I'll have questions about some things, but it really is about trying to figure out how I feel about them or to make sense of maybe something that's going on that bothers me. And that's how it comes out. So on a certain level, it is there are ideas behind it, but I think that writing about them is really just trying to make sense of my feelings. Do you know what I mean? I think it is more, it's something not just cerebral, or I would have enjoyed writing essays more than like academic papers more than I actually did. I love writing fiction. I love writing poetry. And it's satisfying in a way that's very different, I think. And in a way it feels more honest, because it is more sort of personal in that way. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Yeah. I mean,
like an academic paper on something. That's not as satisfying to me in the same way.
I understand that. I think like my last book was, it's nonfiction. But for me, it became interesting in trying to piece together stories. Right. Because I always approach things from like the journalist perspective where I want to go talk to people. And so then it becomes a puzzle, and that becomes really fun, but it's not the same type of way when I'm writing fiction and I'm figuring something out in my attitude or my reflection about whatever that incited this moment that's now taking place in some shape in this story, but it's like really in the background.
Right. And more than like writing an academic paper or something like that. But I understand what you're saying, and it's true. If you feel it, it becomes a different experience writing it, no matter what it is. Do you know what I mean? So, but I, in general, I connect more like that with fiction, you know?
So then what's next for you, lady, as far as your fiction?
No, I'm working on another novel and actually they're a collection of linked stories too. So I'm working on two pieces right now that take up my time.
All right. So I want to switch to a speed round before I let you go for the morning. What is your favorite book?
Probably Song of Solomon. That's what I say today. Again, I have a lot of favorite books, but I've been thinking about that one a lot lately. So
who is your favorite author?
Toni Morrison.
Not surprised there.
Those are easy.
What is your favorite song?
Oh, that is hard. That's a hard one. It's like, I have so many favorite songs. I like St. James Infirmary today.
Just today.
Yeah. Well, more than today, but that's what popped in my head when you said that. I don't know how true it is, because I like a lot of different songs. I like a lot of different music. That's what popped in my head.
You've lived in a lot of different places. So if money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea if money was no That thought has never occurred to me. So I don't know. I would be writing still, though. I still want to write. So I don't know.
Would you stay in New Orleans, or would you, like, the whole world is open to you? Where would you want to go?
I don't know. I might stay in New Orleans. I don't know what New Orleans would feel like with money being no object. So I'm like, that's kind of like
it's kind of a wild, whole different kind of city.
It would be a whole different city. So, but I'm happy here now. That's true. So maybe I'd just be happier if I didn't have to worry about paying any bills. So,
name three things on your bucket list.
Oh my gosh. Finishing these two books that I'm working on. I don't know. I should write a bucket list. That should be. I don't have a bucket list. That's an interesting question. These are like questions for life. You know. I don't know. I really don't even know. I really just want to finish these books. So, complete my thought.
Okay. What brings you joy?
Other people, my children, writing, reading, other people. Yeah.
And what brings you peace?
Oh, yeah. Well, I get a lot of peace thinking about, I've been very inspired by a lot of really strong human beings. I feel very blessed to have had them in my life. And the feeling that they are with me still, it probably gives me a lot of peace, too.
All right, final question for the day. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of words and work that you've left behind? You do know.
I don't know. Oh my gosh, these questions are like, I need to go like sit and meditate on all of them and just reflect. And wow, I don't know. What would I do if I didn't have to worry about money? I have no idea. Never come up in my life. Like, oh, I had to think about that. I don't know. I want to be honest. I want to be honest writer. I want to do the apps. I want to write as well as I can and as honestly as I can, like emotionally. So I don't really know how to answer that question. I will be trying, I can say, for while I'm here, I will be trying the best I can. That's all I can say. Do you know?
That is enough. Okay. Thank you, Lady.
Yeah. No, it was great talking to you.
Big thank you to Lady Hubbard for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Lady's latest short story collection, The Last Suspicious Holdout, out now from Amistad Books. And if you're not following Lady, follow her on the socials. She's at Lady Hubbard on Instagram. And Lady is LADEE. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Lady about how her love of dancing helped her become a better writer. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Jhené Hardin, author of the novel 42 Minutes.
So when it came to me wanting to tell a story infusing mental health, I wanted to be able to talk about mental health and also, you know, have teens get excited about reading again. But also I'm still kind of infusing like different, like, hey, this is what anxiety might look like for some people. This is what, you know, schizophrenia might look like for some people. Or this is what, you know, even poverty, you know, because I think 42 Minutes, really, it's a story of poverty. That's what it is.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.